We're back. How's it going, everybody? Welcome to the show. Welcome to your Tuesday morning. Hope you're having a good start to it. 7:13, JR Simmer and Hammer with you. Pierre McGuire will join us after 8. We'll talk a little hockey with him. In fact, we have a few hockey guests for you today. Nicholas Moldenhauer. It's just not a name that flows that easily off the tongue, but I'm not a play-by-play guy. Kenny Walls is, and A.J. Jakubek is. They'll have to deal with the 15-year-old first-round draft pick of the Ottawa 67s, chosen on Saturday. He's going to join us on the show. We'll talk about his hockey journey, such as it is, that will bring him to Ottawa, presumably for the next hockey season. He'll join us later on the show, as will now former Ottawa Senator Chris Weidman, who was here in Ottawa for a few seasons. Time in Ottawa kind of came to an end, but the Uber thing, I think, probably kind of accelerated his exit from the Sens, but certainly was an integral part of the 2017 playoff run that we'll visit tonight, by the way, as part of our best 10 of the last 10. It's the Sens and Bruins. Series clinching win for Ottawa in overtime, thanks to Clark MacArthur. We'll have that game for you tonight at 6 o'clock, but Chris Weidman will be on the show a little later on today as well.
Yeah, and I think one of those players at 30 years old, too good for the American Hockey League, but you get the opportunity, you got the feel. I thought when he went to Edmonton after Ottawa, something would happen for him. But in the truest sense, once set up in the offensive zone, certainly a good power play guy, but not necessarily that skater you want in a smaller player. So I think that adjustment would be a great fit for Europe. And also, hey, he was a real popular guy here and always terrific with the media, so it'll be fun to catch up with him and relive what was a pretty good time here in Ottawa.
Absolutely. And spent this past season in San Diego playing for the Gulls, which is the farm team of the Anaheim Ducks. Of course, is a native of... Are we catching up within St. Louis? Did he, when you check?
Yeah, he is back in St. Louis, yeah.
Yeah, to spend a lot of his offseason. And when things aren't completely shut down as they are right now, there's a pretty good crew of folks, including the Kachucks, of course, and Logan Brown, and a lot of players that live in the St. Louis area.
Yeah, it's incredible. And you go back to St. Louis, and part of it is that a lot of ex-players have met, I guess, probably settled down. Lots of married girls, but even if you didn't, it's such a beautiful area. But to imagine... Imagine back to the 80s, there's a team that did not draft in one entire draft, threatened to move to all places of good old Saskatoon. And if you had been to St. Louis previous to the new building, I couldn't believe early 90s, doing a little TV for the Caps at the time, going to the old building that they played in. If you want to call something a crap hole, like there's nostalgic, okay, and the old dirty Boston Garden, and you kind of, this place, like...
The Checker Dome?
It was owned by Purina.
Ralston Purina, for those that don't remember that far back, Ralston Purina, the dog food company, actually sponsored the hockey rink, which was known as the Checker Dome.
I shouldn't say that, because I think dog food is probably of an excellent mix. It really was, and that franchise was just teetering. Also look back to the crazy Mike Keenan exit out of New York in 1994, and I believe it was actually Jack Quinn was the president of the team. All the shenanigans they pulled back in the day. They were one of the worst economic teams. They gave Scott Stevens one of the first offer sheets. That's when he left Washington. But when Mike Keenan went in there, the craziness of the damage they did to the NHL. To my point, it's been a roller coaster. But the stability is always if you've got kids playing. And right now in the United States, there's not a hotter place when it comes to youth hockey than the St. Louis region.
Michigan has really, really slowed down. Unfortunately, I think economics have a large role in because it used to be Michigan, Minnesota, and Massachusetts, right? It was the three M's that churned out all the players, and certainly Minnesota still does. Massachusetts, I think, maybe less so than Michigan, but I think it's fallen off a little bit. But we're seeing these kind of pockets, and St. Louis has been around since 1967, so I'm not saying it's new as far as churning out hockey players, but it's interesting, Simmer. You have St. Louis starting in 67, we've seen that in the last few years, a lot of players coming out of that. Like Pittsburgh has been around since 1967. They've certainly had more team success, especially in the last 30 years.
Yeah.
And yet, boy, it's a very short list of hockey players that come out of Pittsburgh.
Well, that little region, and that always scares me with the National Hockey League, there's still, to me, that triangle between D.C., Pittsburgh, and Philadelphia that gives you nothing. Now, positive is Penn State has a world-class program, but as you start to go north, what's so important is that in and around New York, there's so many kids coming out of that area. And what had happened in mass for years, for whatever reason, I remember there were years with the World Junior team, they didn't have any players. Now, that has really come back strong. They've kind of reformulated their program. the next wave of this, as we see kids from California and all these other states, I think the next really big one is going to be Illinois and Wisconsin. I know that the University of Illinois, some of those schools have talked about getting hockey programs back. And I think the Blackhawks effect will certainly be huge. But you're right when it talked about Michigan, because Michigan growing up, Detroit Compuware, Little Caesars, and that whole program, that was almost the entire engine of hockey. But hey, it's spread out. It's never been healthier. More important for the NHL, there's just a lot of really good young American players coming up right now.
All right. More on baseball's plan to return to action. Now, spent a lot of time in the first hour on that coming up, but tell you what, let's visit this. Let's visit some birthdays today, some sports birthdays, and this day in sports history as well. And by the way, if you're celebrating today for any reason, happy birthday to you! And a shout out for anybody, all the essential workers heading to work at this hour. All right, this day in sports history, 1963, 23-year-old Jack Nicklaus won his first of how many Masters green jackets. Jack owns more than anybody else. How many green jackets does Jack Nicklaus own?
He's won, 18 majors?
He has won 18 majors.
I'm going to say that I'll go the highest number. I'm going to go six green jackets.
Six green jackets. Hammer.
Yeah, I was saying six in my head as well.
Curious that both of you guys guessed the correct answer of six.
Oh, no, I did. Yeah, well,
good job, Summer. Congratulations.
I'm working from a closet with no access to the internet.
He had a computer right behind
him. He's
got
a phone in his hand constantly.
Only coffee and water. As soon as I said six, I thought, boy, that's awfully high. It is six. Okay, I didn't know.
Yeah. The last one
that was a random guess.
The last one came in 1986. Of course, that was when he was 46 years old.
That is that the Greg Norman meltdown?
No, that's okay. No, okay, no, that was okay. Jack's big comeback. I mean, he had 30 on the back nine. That was the yes, sir. Yeah, one of the most iconic calls of all time when he holed a putt on 17, I believe. And I'm going to look it up.
Okay,
I believe because on TSN it's Masters Week. Last night was Mike Weir's win in 2003. I think tonight is the 1986 Masters when Jack Nicklaus with that really bright yellow shirt.
Yeah, they're actually doing
Sunday.
They're doing two a day. Also famous to the backstory to that, right? His son was on his bag, was he not?
Is that Gary? Not, yes, yeah, I believe so.
That's a big part of kind of the interview, right? And kind of trying to get him going and how they felt there was something special. Was Norman a little bit earlier in the 80s then?
Well, his meltdown was in 96.
Oh, that late. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And on this date in 2003, Syracuse University won its first NCAA basketball championship under Jim Boeheim, beating Kansas 81-78 in the final, led by Final Four MVP and freshman. Anybody remember? Still playing in the NBA. Barely hanging on. In and out of the game.
Wow.
Carmelo Anthony be your answer there.
Wow.
Because he's with Portland now. Just signed, has played about 10 games with the Trailblazers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Not one of the more likable characters, but he has had a nice career for himself. When you first said that, I was trying to think of playing. Of course, Allen Iverson went to Georgetown. And you think for Jim Boeheim and the formation of the Big East, right? How many great teams that Syracuse has had over the years. And so many great opponents to go against and all the great, the upsets. So Villanova's won. Did St. John's always had some great programs? Providence had great programs.
Yep.
Obviously, Georgetown as well.
Well, you think about, Rick Pitino was in Providence.
That's right.
Luke Carnesecca was at St. John's with Chris Mullen back in the
day. Massimino at Villanova.
Yeah, through the 1980s was unbelievable. And in fact, there's a great ESPN 30 for 30 on the Big East, as it was known back then. Yeah. And on this day in 1977, let's take you back 43 years. It was a snowy day in Toronto when this happened.
Bill Singer will face a tough hitter, left-hander Ralph Garr.
And one of the fastest base runners in the American League.
Here it is, the first pitch in Blue Jay history. It's a strike for the fastball. That ball has been exchanged and will go to the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame.
There you go. There is the legendary Don Chevrier, an Ottawa guy, on the call of the first ever Toronto Blue Jay game on this day, April 7th, 1977. And that was 44,649 fans chanting We want beer at Exhibition Stadium in Toronto because it was the only ballpark in Major League Baseball that was not licensed back in 1977.
Wow, and I've always thought when it comes to booze, we're ahead of the curve. And if anybody's been to a game at Exhibition Stadium, especially that time of year, final year of junior, I played in Oshawa 88-89. Quick exit from the playoffs, and my buddy Ian Fraser and myself went down to a game there. And I still just remember we were out in, what was it, left field that extended where you'd sell it, but it kind of drifted away.
Yes.
Where right field was wide open.
Yes.
Right field always had all the cars parked to the players.
Correct.
They all drove a Honda Accords from the local dealership, which I thought, how cool that must have been. I just remember the snowball fights, and I remember everybody getting into fights. And as security would take you out, everybody would do that, na-na-na-na, hey, goodbye, all the chants. But it was a cold day, right? And I could imagine, I don't know what it was like for opening day, but April on the old Lake Ontario at the old stadium there was not great necessarily weather for baseball.
They actually used the Zamboni from Maple Leaf Gardens to take the snow, help take snow off the field at Exhibition Stadium.
Yeah.
Final score in the game, to the Blue Jays win or lose their first ever game? Well, who did they play? Who did they play in their first ever game? Who remembers that?
Hammer probably already knows.
I can't say exactly.
I'm feeling a little White Sox action.
Chicago White Sox is the correct answer there.
I think that they won like 8-7 or something. I thought it was a higher score.
9-5 would be your correct answer.
Okay.
And here is the guy, with all due respect to Bill Singer, who threw out the first pitch in Blue Jay history on this day. This is the man who will be forever remembered for that first game.
Brett deals, hard hit ball, power alley, left center field, home run! Dugout hits the first homer in Blue Jay history and will score the first one.
There you go. Doug Ault had the first home run in Blue Jay history and would actually have a second home run in that game as part of that 9-5 win by the Blue Jays.
Yeah, go back to some of those old uniforms, go back to the song that came, what, early 80s, Let's Play Ball, the franchise, and both the Expos.
What do you want?
Yeah, oh man, I love it. Hey,
Let's
we got to fire that up
ball.
After. I thought that was actually really cool. Also, too, and I know they both had their struggles, it was neat, and I was an Expos fan, 80s, and whatever team was better, I probably cheered for. I love the fact of the mix at the players, right, with George Bell, and you look at the Expos roster, they were quite ahead of the curve in the Dominican Republic, were they not? Kind of the Los Angeles Dodgers model.
Yeah.
We're one of the few to set up shop there. And boy, they both had incredible farm systems at that time when you think to the late, great Tony Fernandez and all the players that came through.
Well, if you're looking for something to do, Simmer, you can watch, or JR, you can watch the entire game as it's available on YouTube. No commercials, so it only goes an hour and 43 minutes.
Now, that's perfect for baseball. That's what baseball needs to try to achieve. You know, the commercials, that's part of it right now. But if we're talking about baseball reinventing itself in a COVID-19 world, you could make games that are $1.43.
Baseball, and a high-scoring game, too.
Baseball would be back in everybody's good books again, as opposed to these, you know, three. What was the average time of a game? Did they get it below 3 hours?
No way.
It's about 305, 306. Way too long.
Yeah.
All right. Celebrating a birthday on this day, Tony Dorsett, Hall of Fame running back with the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah.
Was born in, hard to believe now, 1954. For Tony Dorsett.
Wow. I always think about him and Danny White and those Dallas Cowboys teams that probably could not get a whole lot done after Roger Staubach, right? There was always kind of that negativity. And Tony Dorsett had that. He had a little bit of the Sugar Ray Leonard, did he not? That great smile and kind of the baby face going as well.
Holds that well, is actually shares the record for the longest touchdown in NFL history because it can never be broken unless they lengthened the field and made it a CFL-length field. That 99 yards, I believe it was on Monday Night Football, had a 99-yard run against the Minnesota Vikings to tie the record. Born on this day and having a birthday day, sharing a birthday because they're twins, the Barber twins, Rondé and Tiki Barber.
Ooh.
Born on this day in 1975, so celebrating 45th birthday. Adrian Beltre, longtime Major League Baseballer, born in 1979, so he's 41. He had 3,000 career hits, which is fairly under the radar. How many players in Major League Baseball history do you think have 3,000 or more career hits?
12?
Oh, it's got to be more than 12.
Okay. I'm stealing numbers here.
3,000 or more?
Yep.
I'm going to go high 28.
Pretty good. 32.
Wow,
32.
Nice.
The last person to achieve that, Albert Pujols,
in the 2018 season. May the 4th became the 32nd. Previous to that, Adrian Beltre had gotten to 3,000 career hits. So he's celebrating a birthday today. And speaking of one-hit wonders in the world of sports, celebrating a birthday today. In fact, he is turning a ripe old 60.
Wow. Buster Douglas?
Buster Douglas.
See, Mike Duane, when back in his field, doesn't have the good balance, his legs together is busted, landing these... Oh, nice uppercut by Buster Douglas! Look at this! He's knocked Mike Tyson down for the first time in his career! Mike Tyson hits the canvas! He's in big trouble! He may not be able to recover! It's up to 7 and 8! He's not gonna make it! Unbelievable! 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 Buster Douglas is the new heavyweight champion of the world!
That was in 1990, as a matter of fact. Yeah. James Buster Douglas knocked out Mike Tyson, who then was the biggest, baddest, meanest, scariest boxer, certainly that a lot of us maybe had ever seen. And for Buster Douglas, who was a relative, I still remember it. The fight was somewhere in the Far East.
Was it in Tokyo?
Yeah. Was it okay, Japan? Because I remember it was on a. I don't remember. I remember waking up on the Sunday morning.
It was in Tokyo.
I remember waking up on the Sunday morning, and it was like, and we didn't have the internet back then, kid.
You checked your phone right away.
I don't remember where I heard it. Maybe
they'd put still shots on the news. I remember that was, they'd show the picture, and it all of a sudden was this incredible media storm, as you said, to Buster Douglas. And I think, as I'm thinking about the barbers and Kenny Albert, I think that's Kenny's uncle that's calling that. I think that's Al Albert that's on the call. Did a ton of boxing back in the day. So legendary. And hear the excitement. If Tyson knocks him out, it's not near the relevance.
Nope.
That became, that's right there with the biggest upsets in sports history. Right?
One hit, in this case, one punch wonder Buster Douglas, who went on to, I think he lost his next fight, and that was it. It was all over and done with for him at that time. So celebrating a birthday today is James Buster Douglas. Let's quickly go through the hockey birthdays. Two players with Ottawa Senator ties born on this day. Rob Murphy played a little bit with the Sens, of course, now pro scout with the team, turning 51. And who remembers Jim Pack?
Yeah.
We're talking early days. Ottawa Senators turns 53. He was one of few, only, players born in Korea to play in the National Hockey
League. Yeah, played against Jimmy. Robbie, of course, being local, played in the Quebec League. First round pick of the Vancouver Canucks back in the day. Big guy that could skate. Probably be real good in today's NHL. And Jimmy had some funny nicknames that the Peterborough Petes would call him when he played for the Oshawa Generals. Oh, what a good guy. Was on one of, if not both of, the teams that Pierre McGuire was part of in Pittsburgh that won the Stanley Cup. And Jimmy is just a class act. And if we remember the last time we saw Jimmy, was coaching Korea at the last Olympics, the men's ice hockey team, and just a really, really, really good guy.
Speaking of Pittsburgh, also celebrating a birthday today, bit of a Sens killer back in the day. Pascal Dupuis turns 41 today, 15-year career, over 800 games, won a Stanley Cup with Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Did his career come to an end? It was a Mark Mathot hip check of Sidney Crosby, who landed on the side of Pascal Dupuis' knee, blew it out. I don't know that he ever played again.
No, and there's a guy can still, I believe, broke in with Minnesota and could skate, and Jacques Lemaire taught him how to play. That was one of those really nice pickups by the Pittsburgh Penguins, and flat out, it was the Mark Mathot hip check that led to almost a swinging motion by Dupuis in front of the net. I can't remember if he collided with Sidney Crosby. That was the end. Also led to the end of Mark Mathot's finger being chopped off by Sidney Crosby, as he was going to a pound of flesh? He was going to come back.
Was that the same game?
No. But I have no doubt. Sidney Crosby, one of his best buddies, I have no doubt, first of all, that there was intent the way he slashed Mark, and I have no doubt that he was still pissed off about that hit right there, which was very clean, but players did not like it a whole lot, but still remember that. And that was unfortunate for Dupuis, because he could have played a lot longer the way he could skate.
All right, good listener. And you guys, it is time to play a little trivia. A highest point getter in the NHL, born on this day. And again, Simmer is Thumper the Rabbit with these. Do not shout out the name of what you think when you think you know.
We had some premature evaluation the first time we played. Since then, I've been excellent.
Okay.
So we're good.
Say, I think I've got it. Write it down.
Okay.
You can still visually see Hammer in your isolated closet, so you'll be able to prove to Hammer that you have the right answer. Okay. So here we go, everybody. The highest-born point-getter in NHL history, born on this day, April the 7th, turns 66 years old today. So we're going back a bit. was drafted in the first round, fourth overall, in the 1974 draft. Played in the Western Hockey League. Won four Stanley Cups. Played all but the final two seasons of his career.
I got it.
With the New York Islanders.
I got it.
Is in the Hockey Hall of Fame. 319 goals, 697 points in 958 career games. Not necessarily the greatest statistics, yet Hockey Hall of Fame. That may be your hint right there before Simmer guesses. Hammer, you must have a guess on this.
I do have a guess, but I cannot remember his name because he just entered the Hall of Fame in, was it the last 5 years?
New York Islanders.
And I can't remember his name.
Massive hairdo, massive
big
man.
Big beard. My life right now.
Big beard.
If you go back to his team pictures with the Regina Pats, it looks like he looks like Andre the Giant in the team picture.
All right, Simmer, who is it?
Clark Gillies.
Clark Gillies is the correct answer. Yeah. Turning 66, of course, skated on a line with Brian Trotsche and Mike Bossy on those Stanley Cup winning teams for the Islanders in the early 1980s. And I will say, somewhat controversially added to the Hockey Hall of Fame. Statistically, not necessarily there, and it shouldn't all be numbers-based. It also shouldn't be just because you won a cup. Should be a nice mix. I you know, and I'm going to be honest with you, I do not think that he's in my Hockey Hall of Very Good.
No.
Not my Hockey Hall of Fame.
No, and again, a nice player. Similar to Mr. Greening, scoring goals with Spets and McCulloch. He was a limited player. Even on his team, you think about Nystrom. And if you go to a game in the island, they've got all those beautiful banners, and it starts with Billy Smith over to Dennis Potvin. Then you've got Nystrom to Gillies to Brian Trotsche to Mike Bossy. All of those are retired from it, but you're right. And hey, we had Theo Fleury on a couple of weeks ago. I can't for the life of me, and I won't present it to Pierre McGuire because I know he won't discuss it. I can't for the life of me understand when you look at Theo's career and forget about what he overcame, but just look at his numbers. Look at his international career. The fact that he's not in the Hall of Fame ahead of the likes of Guy Carboneau and Clark Gillies makes no sense.
Well, as has been discussed, and Pierre is a voter. That's why, as you said, he can't discuss it. It is, at the end of the day, there is some there's some politics to who gets in as much as you know, some people would dispute that. As you said, the agents are very powerful now.
Yeah.
They have the ability to sway a lot of the votes.
Well, and for Theo, the late, great Don Baisley had a small stable of players between he and Solani and Sakic. He has passed away. I think, and I know Theo pissed off a lot of people, including the entire dressing room in Calgary, that wanted out, but I would like to think people at this point would circle back for all the work he's done and understanding what he's gone through and start trying to lobby and say, hey, even to Lanny McDonald is a former teammate of his. And I know that players say he pissed off a lot of guys, but I think enough water's under the bridge at this point.
All right, we'll take a break. 7:36. When we come back, baseball's plan to return to action may be the most viable one we've heard so far. All right, so we'll get into details on that and what it all might mean and when we might see baseball return. This is all, again, blue sky spitball, best case scenario. And we'll come back, we'll discuss that. Golf is out with a revised schedule for sure. Now, whether it actually comes off or not, that remains to be seen. So we got a little bit of that, some hockey news, a little bit of football stuff as well as we continue along here. It's Tuesday morning, a nice, bright, sunny Tuesday here on Sports Radio, TSN 1200. His birthday is next month. Are we really going to see a 15-year-old up at 8:45 in the morning when he's scheduled to join us? Can we maybe put some odds on that? I know he's got to do online schooling.
Yeah.
Like all the kids do, but 8:45 for a 15-year-old?
I was shocked when we had DiPietro on a couple of years ago, didn't understand the Ottawa 67 schedule, and I thought on a daily basis they were up at 6, they were going and doing some of the schooling, some of the training, different than back in the day when we played junior hockey practice at 4 in the afternoon.
Did none of the schooling and none of the training.
Well, yeah, you know what, the training, usually about a week before training camp, decided might give it a go, but for the most part, no. It's a whole different animal, right, what you're dealing with and the kids and the parents and the advisors. And hey, there is some negative to it, but on the higher end, we have never produced more NHL ready and we have never produced better hockey players. Yeah. So it's unfortunate for lots of other kids that can't kind of hold on, and there's some bad stories, but for the elite athlete, it's a whole different world now.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris Weidman will join us on the show as well just after 9 from St. Louis. Chris, of course, the former Ottawa Senator, will be by. We'll relive some Some happier times back here in Ottawa, including his memories of the 2017 playoff run, of which he was a part of and of which we will visit tonight. With our best 10 of the last 10, we've got Sens Bruins. The playoff clinching, series clinching win by the Sens in overtime thanks to Clark MacArthur's goal in overtime. We'll have that game for you tonight at 6 o'clock with Dean Brown and Gord Wilson. Couple of quick texts at 12-1200. Hey, guys, I want to thank Simmer for introducing me to the fine sport of cornhole. Oh, not nice. Only am I hooked, but I think the entire sport would be better without spectators.
Yeah.
Also, the CFL and the NFL should add an extra F and play flag football this year. That comes from Rob.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Nothing wrong with a strong game of flag football. You've done, is it called Frisbee football or Frisbee?
Ultimate.
Ultimate. No, okay. But no.
Don't pretend you don't know the fine sport, as you would
no,
say.
No, because honestly, when you first brought it up, and I think I irritated you a little bit, I thought it was the course he had out in Canada, and that's the Frisbee golf. This is the Frisbee football.
Not
that's
to be false. Confused.
So you have that. And as far as the cornhole, I could see it making a bit of a comeback here as far as crowds. I think it's important that the players are drinking when they play. Like, there's certain sports, right? Between darts, billiards, and cornhole, said players yes. should be a big keg there as a sponsor, and you should just be working that keg while you play.
I love that. Yeah. Mentioned that if you're up early enough this morning when it was still dark, you would have seen a spectacular moon. And I mentioned that tonight will be officially the full moon, even though it looked full to me. But I asked somebody did a text in this morning, said moon fact check. The moon is full tonight at 10:35 officially. And number two, the largest full moon of the year was actually last month. Tonight will be the closest the moon and the Earth are together. Okay. Now, does that make it? Now, he says our fact checker says the largest. Is the largest to be confused with the brightest or the largest in terms of what it would appear to our eye? That part I don't know. That's a little bit beyond me. All I can tell you right now is if you get a chance, especially if you don't live kind of downtown, you get a lot of light. If you can go out somewhere where it's somewhat dark, the moon last night, I mean, I didn't even really know. And then I saw it this morning when we woke up and drove to work. Yeah. It was spectacular.
Yeah, and don't want to get too technical, but I don't think the moon swells bigger or smaller.
I just meant how it would appear to the human eye.
I'm joking. Yeah. It was pretty cool this morning just to wake up. You hear the birds. These are terrible times right now. And just a little bit of nice weather yesterday and to feel that and even wake up this morning seeing that we can enjoy a little bit of nature right now.
Absolutely. Speaking of nature, golf announced a revised schedule yesterday. Now, again, this is they've actually put dates to things, whether they actually happen or not, and if they do happen, whether there'll be fans there or not. We don't know any of that. But they have left actually a hole in the schedule as early as the month of June to play the Memorial Tournament, the one that is played at Jack Nicklaus's course, Firestone in Ohio. But as far as the big events go, the majors, they have all been rescheduled except for the British Open. The Open Championship has been officially canceled yesterday by the RNA. They have just said they, like Wimbledon, have just said, look, and I don't know why, but they've made the early call. Wimbledon announced last week, no tournament this year. We're just coming back in 2021. Yeah. The RNA announced the same for the Open Championship, so there'll be no British Open. But the other three majors have all been rescheduled, starting with the PGA Championship the first weekend of August. Then August will be they'll go right into the Tour Championship, which is, and how they're going to come up with the top 120, if they're going to go with the same guys as last year, or how they're going to do that, whittle their way down to the FedEx to Championship, right? And I'm assuming the $10 million will still be up for grabs.
Yeah.
Then it is right to the U.S. Open, which will be held in mid-September. Weekend after that, right into the Ryder Cup in late September. And then we're going to take a little bit of a break, and then we're going to play the Masters in early November, believe it or not, which is, about 7 months later than it would be. Normally, this is actually Masters week. The Masters should be gearing up for Thursday start to the Masters. Instead, it'll be November 12th to the 15th. Right now, they're saying with, as they call them, patrons, fans, that will remain to be seen if that will actually happen. But you mentioned weather-wise. I mean, it'll look different. We're not going to have the beautiful flowers that we would have as we have typically in the spring. So
yeah.
Augusta National will look different. It will also play a little bit different because it is a little bit cooler. It'll be a lot wetter. So the ball is not going to roll as far. So the course itself will play a lot longer. And ESPN's Andy North, who is a former professional player, weighed in last night about the whole idea of the Masters and any of these other majors, any of these huge competitions in golf being played without fans.
If the PGA in California is played and they're not able to have fans, how big an impact is that, Andy, to the ability to play a tournament, in your belief?
Well, I think that's a big deal. I don't see a reason to play major championships if you don't have the fans there. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I happened to play in an event years ago where the temperatures were so hot they didn't allow fans out there, and it was really weird. And so much about major championships is the whole vibe of the event, and I hope that we're able to do that. That's the one nice thing about the Masters. Going in November, there's better chance of that happening than any other scenario you could possibly have.
So just to make sure I understand you, what you're saying is the fans provide sort of a vital element for the players to play off of. The absence of them would in a sense, almost be problematic for the players?
Well, I just don't think it's the right thing. If we can't run an event the way it should be, I don't think it's worth having.
So that is an interesting take, but of course these are, as I've said many times, I got to come up with a new cliche, but uncharted waters we're in right now. Yeah. He mentioned the one tournament, I don't know which one it was, that where they didn't have any fans because of the heat. We're now talking about a circumstance in which right now we're not allowing people to congregate because of a virus that we can't even see. Mm-hmm. So where that is in the month of, starting in the month of August with the PGA Championship. But I found that to be an interesting take. Again, he played the game at a very high level. Yeah, he won a couple of U.S. Opens, did Andy North. So he comes from with the voice of experience. But the whole idea of, hey, if we can't have fans at the majors at least, I don't think we should even play them.
Yeah, it is. But I also think, as you said, you have to adjust the golf course itself. Will it be different for the players? Does every sport and every player practice without people? Well, it's a little bit different when you're a golfer. Golfers play thousands of rounds where there's nobody around doing it. Does it take away from it? For sure it does. I don't see it be a big deal. And also to the golfers, which should help. A lot of the major golf courses in the United States, Southern United States, are still open. A lot of these guys, I'm sure, in their private course, continue to play. So when they do decide to get up and running, whether it be, is it Day lives out in Wisconsin?
Jason Day lives in Ohio. Yeah,
Ohio. And he's got that cool little garage that he hits right out of, right?
Yep.
Hey, all these guys are playing, they're hitting, they're ready to rock and roll. And I appreciate, as an old school person, and he even threw a little vibe in there, it's not the same, but will they pull it off? For sure. And when you also talk to the players and you look at the money involved, we can talk about huge money as far as maybe relaunching to some brands. But when you look at the TV market, and I don't want to, it's not a rush, but realizing probably what they could grab a hold of, no, it won't be the same, but I'd have no issue with it.
Yeah, I think an interesting take on all of this, and why I think there's, and there's many reasons why there's a reluctance of all the sports, be they individual sports or team sports, to kind of pull the plug on their current seasons and say, hey, we'll come back somewhere down the road, is the idea of you telling, in golf in particular, you telling your major sponsors, we'll come back in a year. We've got nothing for you this year to run commercials on during television broadcasts or sponsor tents at actual events.
Yeah.
You tell your sponsors to go away. There's a chance that they go away and they never come back.
Yeah.
Like that is a huge part, I think, for a lot of sports right now, in why there really is a reluctance to say, yeah, we're not going to play any games. They don't want to push the sponsors any further than they are.
Yeah.
They want to keep that carrot dangling as long as they possibly can.
Yeah, no, and then the reverse will be how many of the tournaments, based on the sponsors, what they're going through economically, do they want to, first of all, be associated with giving a guy a multi-million-dollar prize? Do they have the money? Will there be a charitable component? And it's funny around the world, because you often hear in Asia when they talk about a decline of something happening, where a lot of local sports teams are sponsored by industry, they feel it's in poor taste to continue the sport, so that's usually the first thing to go. And I see over in the KHL in Russia, one of the major people, owners of the teams, and they're all funded by rich people, there's no real revenue, they folded the team for next year. They've already said, listen, whatever funds are allocated for the payroll, we're going to shift to the fighting of coronavirus. So I think there's lots of different pressure points, but I think there'd probably be a reaching out, and to your point, for sure that. But also just, where is every company, both economically and comfort level, of sponsoring events? And hey, you look to, the Masters doesn't matter, but to the other ones, like I said, I think everybody's just trying to continue out in a feeling out process. And if they can have it come back, then I think everyone would be thrilled to be involved.
Spent a lot of time in the first hour talking about a plan unveiled last night by Jeff Passan of ESPN, put forward by Major League Baseball, not officially, but a plan to return to the diamond, potentially as early with a 2 to 3 week training camp in the month of May and games as early as June. And very quickly to kind of summarize how this would work, essentially, as we've heard with many of the spitball ideas that are out there, the players would be brought to one central location. And this, in this particular circumstance, it's to the state of Arizona and the area of Phoenix. There are 13 spring training and or minor league parks that are of major league size, where they could play the games, and also at Chase Field, which is the home of the Arizona Diamondbacks. Mm-hmm. If you had triple headers, so three games a day at Chase Field, and then had the other 13 parks, you would have enough capacity, places to play, 15 games in a day. There are 30 major league teams. You could play a full complement of games. So in terms of how that would work, they would have enough fields. So the players would essentially live in isolation. They would all be put up in hotels. They would be bused to the ballpark and then bused home when the game is over. In terms of the games themselves, they're talking about not having a home plate umpire. Of course, physical distancing is a huge part of what they're trying to get across. So they would use the electronic strike zone, maybe have the home plate umpire stand over to the side in case there's a play at home plate. But have an electronic strike zone, have no mound visits, have with the ability to make up games because they're getting a very late start in the year to play as many games as they could, to have seven inning double headers in some cases. Now, how that would work in the field in which they'd have triple headers, I have no idea. That would make for a very long day of baseball.
Yeah.
Expanded rosters. And during the games themselves, you wouldn't have players sitting in the dugout when their teams were at bat. They would actually all sit in the stands 6 feet apart. Mm-hmm. So, and again, there would be no fans at any of these games. And none of these sports we're talking about at this early stage, you're talking about having fans at any of their events. So that is baseball's, and this is apparently them talking to the folks at the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, with the national health experts. And again, a large part of all of this is going to be the fact that there are, and you know, from Donald Trump to Fauci to a lot of the medical experts say that the ability to test and test more is coming. Like the ability to get tens of millions of tests, that is going to be coming sooner rather than later. The ability to turn around those tests quickly, perhaps in a matter of minutes, mm-hmm. where you can have an athlete take a test and within 10 minutes know if he's positive or not, and therefore be able to remove an athlete from this bubble very quickly where you wouldn't have to. It wouldn't be a house of cards where you had to isolate everybody else from the team as well. Mm-hmm. That is kind of by the time frame we're talking about, so a month to 2 months from now, the ability to do that from a health point of view. This is why they think there's a chance that this could work.
Yeah, I think you're looking at this conceptually. First of all, you mentioned the bus. Assumption is you can't all get on the same bus. So if you are going to do that, I think realistically you'd have to come up with a concept of, okay, let's take each individual team and be realistic about interaction of players. When a guy hits a home run, obviously, I guess you try not to high five. But can you keep a group of players realistically far enough apart where from the hotel to eating, is it all room service to transportation to everything else?
But do you have to keep them apart if they've been tested that day? If I'm negative and I test negative, I don't have to be kept apart from someone.
No, that's
I
my,
have
that,
to be kept
that,
apart from the general public.
Yeah, that's
but
my
for
point.
Everybody who's in my bubble, I can play Xbox with somebody sitting beside me on the couch to while away the hours.
Well, and that's exactly the point then. And I don't see where, hey, you come, you sit in the dugout together. So basically you are a traveling team together and you're testing. I think that's something like that's more realistic from a transportation to hotel. Hey, each team almost has their home hotel, whatever they do for housing for the players when they have all these spring trainings. And if you've been to Phoenix, Phoenix. Hey, there's tons of facilities there. So yeah, I can see some merit to it. Remote broadcasters, I guess. You turn over the teams, the games, you end up doing something like that. So, no, as I said, I think they're trying to, at the mandate of the president, just get people talking about some concepts without being foolish, without putting anybody at risk. But that would be more realistic to me now, also to baseball and to any sport. If you are going to stay for a couple of months, you know, do you involve a wife or girlfriend, or is it strictly players? There'll be lots of discussions there, but to think one player would stay in his room and do his thing, treat it as a team and a concept and live in a bubble world, and if you can pull it off, that'd be great.
Yeah, there's so much money at stake, right? And then at the end of the day, the players, and this will have to be collectively bargained, and the players will have to sign off on it. And will there be unanimity either way, either 100% agreement or 100% disagreement? Not a chance.
Yeah.
So it will be, in all likelihood, majority rules, and what they hope will be a vast majority will rule. But can you keep everybody in, if this isolation, if this bubble that they're playing in lasts as long as 3 or 4 or 4.5 months to do some semblance of a full season? Would a player want? I mean, it's all great to say at the top, "Hey, you're gonna make the vast majority of your $15 million. You're gonna get it."
Yeah.
Sounds great in concept, and then you go and play it, and for a while, it's kind of fun. And whether I have my family there, okay, I can make. And then the grind sets in at one point.
Oh, for sure.
And you're not getting the payoff of playing in front of fans. I mean, that is a huge part of being an athlete. Whether you call it adoration or whatever, just the motivation of playing in front of, you're playing in empty stadiums.
Yeah.
And boy, I tell you what, after a while, and baseball's already a slow game, after a while you're playing, you know, you're down, 7-1 in the seventh inning in an empty stadium. And it's like, oh my God, I can't get this game over with fast enough.
Yeah.
And that becomes to where, and your team is at 31-70, you're the Detroit Tigers. What is your motivation as a player at that point?
Well, I got to be honest with you, though. Most baseball players are conditioned to play in front of nobody. I mean, what did the Blue Jays have down the stretch last year? Are you talking 4,000? I mean, if you're a Pittsburgh Pirate or you've been in one of these terrible franchises, I think part of that's been conditioned now to the money. Now, from a social aspect, at what time or what spot will a player look for some visitation and look for a, you know, whoever you may want to invite? Trying to control that almost from a security standpoint to get everyone, as you said, to buy in. Yeah, like I said, it would take a lot of work. 4 months, I think that's tough. Also, when you start picking off some of the Houston Astros players, I'm assuming that they love this concept, right? Because you would look so bad if you're going to chase me down or try to pick a fight when we've got this going, right? So,
well, they'd have to have it, these would be expanded rosters. So you mentioned maybe as opposed to the 26 it is now, maybe 30. Houston would be allowed 40 because all their players would be on the disabled list after getting hit.
No, exactly. And you know, is that even more of a threat? What if the ball has coronavirus on it? Is that attempted murder?
Indeed. As someone just texted in this morning, baseball players would need to include at least one wife and one girlfriend per player. So there we go.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, I guess you could get
separate hotels?
Or a two-bedroom suite.
All right, thoughts on that? Always welcome.
With the kitchenette.
Text us at 12-1200. You can tweet at us at TSN 1200. Keep the phone lines always open for you at 750-1200. We'll take a break, touch on more of that as we roll on throughout the course of the morning. We'll take a break, get you the latest news, latest on COVID from 580 CFRA, and return with Pierre McGuire coming up next on TSN 1200.